Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
WBUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Chinese President Jiang Zemin arrived in Chicago today for what is expected to be his final trip to the United States before he steps down from office. He'll fly out to President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas later this week for barbecue and presidential powwow. Their summit will be more symbolic than substantive as the two leaders do the cowboy hat ritual. In the Texas air will be a new tacit acknowledgement of a partnership of convenience between the United States and China, the almighty superpower of today and the rising superpower of tomorrow. As the U.S. contemplates the outlines of a three-front war with Al-Qaeda, Iraq, and North Korea, China suddenly looks like a far better friend than enemy. But what is Beijing's big post-9/11 view of the world, of China's place and way ahead in the era of American preemption? From the other side of the planet, does the planet look big enough for all of us and all our ambitions? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Beijing is Jonathan Kaufman, China Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. Good evening, morning there, and welcome, Jonathan Kaufman.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you, Jonathan. Also with us from Washington is David M. Lampton, professor of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and director of China Programs at the Nixon Center. He's author of Same Bed, Different Dreams, Managing U.S.-China Relations 1989-2000. Good evening and welcome, David M. Lampton.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. Jonathan, to you first in Beijing. Your Jiang Zemin has flown off. He's landed in Chicago. Talk to us first about the anticipation of this meeting for the Chinese. It hasn't had a tremendous amount of build-up here in the States, but we understand China's paying more attention to it.
Well, I think this trip has always been more important to Jiang Zemin domestically than it's been to the U.S. This is something he's always prided himself on being a good steward of U.S.-China relations. And even though he is expected to step down from many of his formal positions in the next month, there's still a continuing power struggle going on about how much influence he'll retain afterwards. So I think this trip for him is important. The photo opportunities are important to show China and his domestic opponents here that he's still a force to be reckoned with. But I think what's changed in the past 4 or 5 days is that beyond just barbecue and cowboy hats, there will be some topics of substance to be discussed at Crawford this time. And
particularly because of North Korea coming out.
Exactly. And I think that what was striking to me was that when the North Korea crisis broke, the State Department officials flew to Tokyo and Seoul, which we expect, but also to Beijing. And I think it's one of the first times, or actually probably the second time since 9/11, that we've seen the U.S. come to China as a partner. After 9/11, they came to China asking for help in dealing with Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Now they've come to China asking for help in dealing with North Korea. And this is the kind of thing that I think means a great deal to the Chinese. For more than 100 years now, the Chinese have been trying to sort of reassert themselves and sort of come back onto the world scene. And I think that in many ways this is a sign to many Chinese, and certainly the Chinese government, that they're once again a force to be reckoned with, and someone who that the U.S. will deal with not necessarily at arm's length and maybe not embracing, but in some kind of a partnership, or at least see that China is a player and recognize that China does have some influence. And that's something the Chinese very much want on the world stage.
It's a big turnaround for Jiang Zemin. He came into power around the time of the Tiananmen Square massacre when relations with the U.S. were at a terrible low. The Bush administration came in with many people in the White House calling China a potential number one threat, and then we had the big flap over the U.S. plane that went down and is held on to by China. What's on the agenda? There's North Korea. Will there be a resumption of military ties, which were suspended with the United States after that incident, Jonathan?
I think there will be. I think there will be the resumption of what's called mil-mil connections, which is meetings of certain military officials. But I think the broader view here is that China is really taking the long view. Their top priority remains their economic development. Their economy is growing at a very rapid rate. They're industrializing rapidly. Cities are growing. China is really booming. There's a gold rush here that's going on, not just for foreign investors, but also for many Chinese as well. And I think if there is a Chinese game plan, it's to not have anything interfere with that. And I think one of the things you're seeing now is that even though personally many Chinese, and certainly many in the Chinese government, feel that the U.S. should not go into Iraq. There's no question of that at all. They oppose that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was talking to an academic last week about this, a Chinese academic who's close to the government. And I said to him, well, if China is opposed to the invasion of Iraq, would they veto the U.N. resolution? And he looked at me and he said, that isn't our fight. Let someone else take the U.S. on that issue.
So China doesn't want to rock the boat.
And I think, exactly. And I think the message here is that China doesn't want anything to get in the way of its number one priority, which is having a strong economy to build up itself both economically and militarily so that in 5 or 10 years it can really step onto the world scene in a major way. It doesn't want to be distracted along the way.
David Lampton, you hear the description from Beijing. Does it jive with what you see there? And I guess after everything we've heard about the big American view of the world in recent months, President Bush talking about American willingness to preempt challenging powers, a kind of global exercise of oversight, the sun coming up on an era of terror. How does China see the world around it and the world ahead?
Well, I think Jonathan's provided a very good description. I'd approach it a little differently, but I come to the same place. And that is, I think after September 11th, there was a debate in China about what is their situation in the world. I think there were people in the military who looked around their borders and said, look, Japan is sending its navy to the Arabian Gulf. Pakistan, our ally of 30 years, is now close to the United States, allowing basing and overflying rights. Central Asia, the United States now has bases there and aircraft and troops.
So they could feel a bit surrounded.
Russia did a U-turn and moved towards the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So many in the security apparatus in China, I think, looked at themselves as encircled. And it fed a kind of a paranoid and a worried view of China's security.
Is that the dominant view?
No, I don't think it is. I think the dominant view is, in fact, quite optimistic. The dominant view, and I think the optimistic view, is that, look, the Bush administration came in prepared to define China as the primary long-term strategic problem for the United States. And after September 11th, the United States now finds itself still in a partially completed war in Afghanistan, perhaps going to take on another major country in the Middle East, Iraq. The Middle East, Palestinian, Israeli situation is marginally stable. And the al-Qaeda organizations in 60 or more countries, and the U.S. is dedicated to fighting it. The United States, as one Chinese told me, the U.S. plate is full. They don't need an enemy of China. And as a consequence, the U.S. is going to be looking for opportunities to cooperate. The recent announcement out of Pyongyang, North Korea, that they have been continuing with the nuclear program further reinforces their view that the United States needs China's cooperation. So I think the dominant view is that China has a breathing spell. The U.S. is going to be preoccupied, and they can focus on the problems Jonathan was talking about of domestic economic development.
Jonathan Kaufman, in Beijing, is that how it looks to you? And what does China make of the Bush administration's kind of aggressive language about the projection of American power? Do they see that as a threat or something that applies only to lesser nations, not to great China?
Well, I think they're being realistic. I think they feel that there is no power, and certainly China cannot rival the U.S. right now. But I think they've also been very shrewd in getting concessions from the U.S., for this help on the war against terrorism and the war against Iraq. For example, the U.S. has agreed to name a Chinese separatist group out in the western part of China as a terrorist group.
A Muslim separatist group.
Most people here feel that that's really just an ethnic group and not a group of terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will be interesting down the road, certainly with issues that will develop in Asia, whether some of the U.S. rhetoric will come back to haunt them. If countries like China, as they become more powerful, begin to use some of the same kind of unilateral language that the U.S. has been using. But I think the thing we have to remember, and I guess one of the things that I'm struck by over and over again about China, is that the Chinese government is very shrewd and very smart. I think after Tiananmen, after 1989, we tend to think of this as kind of a thugocracy, a group of very hard-headed, hard-boiled old communists who just want to repress people. The fact is they survived that crisis when Gorbachev and the rest of Eastern Europe didn't survive their crises. They've remained in power. They've managed an extraordinary economic transformation. And I think they're playing the diplomatic game right now with extraordinary skill. Taiwan, which has always been a flashpoint in U.S.-China relations, which for years dominated the whole talk of the U.S. and China.
And where the Bush administration really came in hard.
And it's receded, and I think what China is doing is instead of threatening to invade or take over Taiwan, they're planning to hug it to death. They're increasing economic cooperation. There's talk now of direct air flights between Taiwan and China. There are more than a quarter of a million Taiwanese living outside Shanghai. There's a tremendous amount of economic investment pouring into China from Taiwan. So I think the Chinese have looked at the world in a very realistic way and said, what's possible now? We're not going to pick fights. And we're really, surprisingly for China, not going to be driven by ideology. This is a very realistic government that could probably sit down with, you know, any number of Bush's political advisors and see the world in much the same way. They don't have any illusions anymore about China's role.
And while they're looking at...
Because of that, in some ways, they're becoming more powerful because they understand their role and how to exploit it.
And while they're sitting with that perspective, your Wall Street Journal crew there, Jonathan, has written, China is becoming the world's manufacturing platform. They're manufacturing everything for almost everybody.
Well, I think that's one of the surprises that we found is that, you know, for decades now, the world has looked upon China as the great market, 1.3 billion people. And if we could sell every Chinese family a toothbrush or a newspaper subscription or anything, you know, that would be sort of the road to riches. It's turned out that China has instead become the world's factory floor. It now produces half of the world's cameras, 30% of its microwave ovens. And it's not just doing low-end exports like toys. It's now beginning to export computer chips, computer routers, very high-end, high-tech materials. What was interesting about that story is that it really showed the impact China is having globally, and it's also affecting the U.S. directly in terms of deflation. One of the reasons why inflation is not increasing rapidly in the U.S. and really around the world is this flood of cheap Chinese imports just across the spectrum is keeping prices down. Now, that's a story that you would think the Chinese government would like, and yet we were just criticized very sharply yesterday by the state-run newspapers here for creating the bugaboo of a China threat and suggesting that China posed a threat to the world. What that says to me is that China is very aware of wanting to keep a low profile. It almost wants to become a stealth superpower. Unlike some countries that act bigger than they are, I think China almost wants to act smaller than it is. It doesn't want to raise alarm bells. It doesn't want to get American workers angry about Chinese imports or American companies angry about using American technology to produce different goods. It wants to just keep on doing these things, increasing its economic power in the hope that down the road, 5 or 10 years, it will be a real force on the world stage, and suddenly the world will turn around and say, this is a country that has to be reckoned with again.
Jonathan, let me put this question to you then. In light of that, when China throws off that cloak of stealth, if it is indeed the stealth superpower coming up with such a huge economic base, do the Chinese imagine that the world stage at that point is big enough for all of us, particularly for China and the United States? Is there room at this table for everyone's ambitions, or is it a zero-sum game somehow?
Well, I think David will probably, you know, speak to this as well. I mean, I think there are two views here. There is one view that says that the U.S. and China are inevitably poised for conflict because the U.S. is the status superpower and China is the rising superpower. And there isn't room for both, and there's inevitably going to be a clash. The other view is much more benign, and I think in a way is the great bet that the U.S. has made on U.S.-China relations for the past 30 years, which is that as China becomes a normal country, as it becomes integrated into the world economic system, it becomes a country that plays by the rules, and that while there may be clashes of interests and disagreements down the road, in fact, you can have a world system in which China, like Japan or like Germany or like many other countries, may have disagreements with the U.S., but they never reach the point of open conflict. I think that's the big question, and in a sense, it's going to be a number of years before we know how that plays out.
Jonathan Kaufman, it's great to have you on tonight. It's about 25 years since you and I first dipped our toes together into China, and it's great to see you back there. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jonathan Kaufman is China Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. We're talking tonight about the view from China, the world according to Beijing, as Jiang Zemin heads for Crawford, Texas. Is there room in the American view of the world for the Chinese view of the world? And how must America's preemption policy look from the Forbidden City, from the Chinese halls of power? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the view from China tonight as Chinese President Jiang Zemin heads for Crawford, Texas. He's in Chicago now. We're looking at the world as Beijing might look at the world and asking you, what China do you foresee in 10 years, in 20? And how does America need China? How does China need the USA? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined by David M. Lampton. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. He's professor of China Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. David Lampton, I wanted to get your response to Jonathan Kaufman's remarks there just as we were going into the break on whether or not China sees the world, the future, as a kind of zero-sum game. Can it rise to the potential that it foresees, that it desires, right alongside the United States, or must it be somehow at the expense of the USA?
Well, I think that the Chinese certainly say, and I think they actually believe, that their future has to involve a stable and cooperative relationship with the United States for as far as the eye can see.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is that China's an enormous country with 1.3 billion people, and all this skylines with tall skyscrapers along the coast and per capita incomes of $4,000 in Shanghai. That's in relatively few places in China. And as you move inland, you find increasing poverty, declining incomes, and enormous social problems. And so I think, frankly, China's leadership cannot see the day when it isn't going to have an interest in economic ties with the United States, getting technology from the United States. And also, in a funny way, China recognizes the United States is important to its security. We have an alliance with Japan, and if we didn't have that alliance with Japan, China would have to spend a lot more money on its own self-defense. China's military is being modernized, and they are spending more money. But if they had a hostile relationship with the United States, they would have to contend with a rearmed Germany or Japan, and certainly more American military might aimed in their direction. So frankly, I think as far as the eye can see, they want to have good relations. It's important to recognize the Chinese are also training a new leadership generation in the United States.
There the so-called fourth and fifth generations.
Right. The fifth generation, the one after the one that's moving in now, will probably include a lot of people trained in the United States. There are about 60,000 Chinese students and scholars in higher education in the United States, most in the best graduate schools.
That's a big wave.
So intellectually, they've thrown their lot with the United States. Well, of course, as countries get more power, their objectives sometimes change. We have to take into account that as China's power grows, its ambitions might grow, and that'll create conflict with the U.S. But I think at this point, we ought to bet on the future of integrating China into the economic order, the international governance order, and count on economics and integration to modulate Chinese desires.
David Lampton, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation tonight Thomas Christensen. He's professor of political science at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Good evening and welcome, Thomas Christensen.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Tom Christensen, take us to Crawford, and I guess the immediate, before we go back out into that future, what are going to be the most burning issues on this table? North Korea almost has to be front and center. How would you stack up the agenda items that in this rather brief meeting will be most important for Washington and Beijing?
I think that there are a couple of other issues that are likely to come up besides North Korea. One of them is Taiwan, and the other one is proliferation, Chinese proliferation.
That is Chinese technology exports that support proliferation of weapons around the world?
Yes, or just weapons proliferation directly. And both have occurred in the past, and the United States has expressed its concern about Chinese proliferation of weapons, and various domestic laws in China have been passed recently. But the devil's always in the details, and the devil's always in the implementation. And
so this is about Washington saying, we don't want you exporting missiles. We don't want you exporting I don't know what other weapons that might turn up against the U.S. or allies of the U.S.
Well, if you look at the North Korean situation, where they got some nuclear technology from Pakistan, apparently, in trade for ballistic missile technology from North Korea, you know, China's fingerprints aren't all over that in a direct sense, in that I don't think China wants North Korea to have nuclear weapons, and I don't think it necessarily approved or supported the North Korean transfer of missiles to Pakistan. But there's little doubt that China is largely responsible for the Pakistani breakthrough in nuclear technology. Without Chinese support, certainly Pakistan would not have been able to get nuclear weapons as quickly as it has.
And does that mean, by extension, responsible for North Korea's step up as well?
No, I wouldn't accuse China of any kind of direct involvement in this, but China also set a tone about missile sales to Pakistan over the years, selling short-range ballistic missiles to Pakistan. And it's very difficult for China to try to restrain North Korea from doing activities that China itself is doing. So on the one hand, you have China participating over a long period of time in Pakistan nuclearization. And on the other hand, you have China selling ballistic missile technology to Pakistan, which sets a certain tone of what's legitimate and not legitimate in the region. And I think on both scores, these types of behaviors are of concern to the United States, particularly after 9/11, because we don't really know where that kind of technology and those systems are going to end up. And I think that the United States and China have a reason to cooperate on proliferation issues. But I keep returning to the Taiwan issue, and I return to it because I agree with David Lampton and with Jonathan Kaufman that there are debates in China and that it seems, like, particularly in a pre-summit period, that the optimists are winning out over the pessimists. But the Taiwan issue is still there. And China is involved in a very fast-paced military buildup across from Taiwan in terms of coercive capacity against Taiwan. The Chinese official defense budget is doubling every 4 years. And China is acquiring from Russia lots of sophisticated technology that will not allow China to catch up with the United States, but will allow China to threaten Taiwan with coercive power and threaten anybody who would want to help Taiwan with coercive power.
And this is a place where the Bush administration drew a deep line in the sand as soon as it came into office.
Well, it drew a line in the sand.
Deeper than we saw during the Clinton 90s.
I think they did make a clearer threat. The problem is that
they said we are prepared to defend Taiwan. Did George Bush not come out with that?
His statement was a little bit more complicated and vague, but he did say we would do whatever it takes, and then he added a sentence that said to help Taiwan defend itself. And so that part was a clause that clause wasn't particularly clear, but he clearly made a stronger statement than anyone before him. The problem is this, that if you have a situation where China is building up military power against Taiwan, which it's doing in a very concerted and purposeful way, and you have a situation where the United States is committed to Taiwan's defense, largely through arms sales and coordination between the U.S. military and the Taiwan military, you have a situation where China has reason to be annoyed with American foreign policy. Traditionally, one of the ways that that China has expressed its annoyance with American foreign policy and arms sales is to delay or refuse cooperation on proliferation.
So it's a kind of lever on the United States.
Yes.
That the United States does not have the power simply to say, you stop that, period.
The United States wants to say stop that, period. And China, even the optimists in China, believe that 9/11 has provided China with the kind of leverage that David Lampton and Jonathan Kaufman talked about, and that the United States ought to be forthcoming. Yes, the United States should cooperate with us, so it ought to do a quid pro quo in Taiwan. I don't see that quid pro quo forthcoming, and I worry not about the short term, but I worry about the longer term, whether Chinese frustration with the lack of direct quid pro quo type offers from
the Taiwan front
will strain this cooperation that we see right now. And I just want to say one last thing, which is before a summit and during a transition, it's very difficult to look long-term about the atmosphere because there's a lot of positive
posturing,
smiling. Mm-hmm. Jiang Zemin does not want to go out of office with a bad portfolio with the United States. Mm-hmm. It'll make him look like he failed. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to go out of office with a bad portfolio on Taiwan. It will make him look like he failed. So he's going to put a smiley face on this. And whether that lasts past the next Taiwan election and into an arms race across the Taiwan Strait, which I think is not only likely but almost inevitable, is open, is an open question.
Mm-hmm. Thomas Christensen, David Lampton, stand by. We've got callers who want to join us. Let's invite them in. Louise is on the line. Hi, Louise. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Yes, I'm concerned about China becoming a superpower. I'm all for the Chinese people raising their standard of living and hopefully getting some democratic rights. But this current regime, I think, is very, very terrible. It's engaged in a severe persecution of people who practice Falun Gong, and it has also interfered with people who practice Falun Gong in this country. Chinese agents have made a blacklist of practitioners. And the U.S. House...
Are you part of Falun Gong, Louise?
I practice Falun Gong, right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. House of Representatives has passed HCON Resolution 188, calling for an end to this persecution and for an investigation into China's illegal activities in this country.
Louise, let me put that to our guest, David Lampton. When China comes up, the human rights issue always comes up. Falun Gong gets itself right out at the head of that parade. What do you make of the state of human rights? Is it something that Washington can credibly be low-key about, or is it something that President Bush has an obligation to speak up loud and clear on right now?
Well, human rights will always be an issue in U.S.-China relations, at least for as far as we can look into the future, and it properly should, and I'm sure President Bush in the meeting will bring that up, along with the other issues that we've been discussing prior to that. Certainly, if China became a superpower, whatever we might mean by that, with its current internal governance practices, mm-hmm. I think we all would have cause for concern in multiple ways. But I think the United States has put itself, made a bet about the future, and that is that as China's economy grows and its power grows, there's going to be the evolution of Chinese society. Rise of a middle class that will want more participation in China in decisions that affect themselves. And so I think you have to think dynamically. By the time China is a great power on the world scene in the sense that our caller, I think, means that, we have to ask ourselves, is Chinese society going to be the same place? And if you look at the change in Chinese society over the last 20 years, it's been phenomenal. It's not perfect, to put it mildly. There are great problems, but it's very different. And you have to really ask yourself, what is Chinese society going to be 20 years from now? Nobody can know the answer to that question, but I think there are a great number of indications that it's moving in a direction most Americans would applaud in general terms. I would just say one other thing about religion in China, without in any way condoning what I think has been a very brutal and almost indefensible campaign against the Falun Gong. Mm-hmm. And that is that China interests people like Tom Christensen and me precisely because so many times contradictory things are going on. At the same time, you have this brutal repression of Falun Gong and house churches and many Protestant sects in China. You also have the phenomenon that Christianity is growing very rapidly in China, and much of it is practiced very openly, albeit with churches that are registered with the state. And you have, a religious flowering of perhaps almost unparalleled terms in world history in terms of the numbers of people that are now practicing religion or Buddhism, Taoism, and very other ethical systems of thought. So at the same time, you have all this repression, you have this flowering. And in fact, I think it's the growth of religion in China activity that scares the regime because it's a form of organization that at least in the past in Chinese history and in world history have turned against not only communist regimes but other authoritarian regimes. And one only needs to think of the role that Catholics and the Catholic Church played in the Eastern Europe in the fall of the Warsaw Pact and the Polish Communist Party and so on.
To see why the Communist Party might be looking over its shoulder.
Sure.
And yet full acknowledgement to the repression that goes on there today. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Christensen, I want to turn to you and ask this. I guess on the front of America's dismay after 9/11 and the new challenges of terrorism and disarray that the country seems to be dealing with, do we have China's sympathy, or is China at some level gratified to see the great hyperpower grappling with all these issues? Does this put us in our place in their view and keep us from hassling Beijing?
I don't think they get a lot of joy out of our suffering on 9/11 for a few reasons. One is that they have some of the same problems at home that we face internationally. They have a separatist movement that is not entirely terrorist in its organization, but has had terrorist attacks both in the northwest part of China and in Beijing itself, and apparently does have some links to international terrorism through al-Qaeda.
I guess I don't mean to ask if they were celebrating 9/11. We accept that they were not. But as the U.S. Considers getting into Iraq and has a global hunt going on for al-Qaeda and that kind of confrontation, does China see this as taking the pressure off in some way, that it keeps the great power in Washington from getting in China's hair?
I think it does in the near term, in the sense that I think that China probably is realistic if the Chinese leaders' assessments are that the United States and its allies don't want to be tied down in a conflict over, say, Taiwan, while they're considering conflict in Iraq or anywhere else in the world. But if that confidence is exaggerated to the point where they believe that the United States will offer some concrete quid pro quo in Taiwan, then they might be disappointed. And that's what I had pointed to before as a concern. One of the things that has to be kept in mind is what David Lampton pointed out so well before, is that China has a kind of mixed attitude about the United States. It's worried, on the one hand, that we'll support Taiwan and we will perhaps encourage Taiwanese movement away from the mainland politically, either into permanent separation or formal legal independence someday. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, China desperately needs its access to the United States for technology and its economy, and that's a big part of the legitimacy of the regime at home. And I think that one of the major concerns in China after 9/11 was that this could deal a very severe blow to the United States economy. Now, that's not standard great power competition as we knew in the 19th century and the early 20th century.
But China needs that market to keep buying up the enormous surplus of manufactured product they produce?
Absolutely, and it needs the investment and it needs the technical expertise. It doesn't want the United States economy to tank. And I once talked to a Chinese military officer about Taiwan at great length at a time when China was more pessimistic about cross-straits relations than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a very interesting statement. He said, we can talk until we're blue in the face about Taiwan, and it's a very important security issue. But at the end of the day, our leadership's big security concerns lie in the U.S. stock market. If the U.S. economy tanks, we're going to be in big trouble because we're going to be in big trouble at home. We're not going to be able to supply the jobs. And many people have talked about how this regime, this Chinese communist regime, is non-ideological. That's true. But it doesn't have a replacement ideology for what it had before. Mm-hmm. And there's a real hollowness in the legitimacy of this regime. And I'm not saying that as an outside critic. People in China are aware of this.
Very well aware of it.
And they're trying to scramble to come up with something. And there's a big debate about the future of China. And I'm very optimistic, as is David, about this. And how Taiwan works out, I think, will have a big impact on what kind of China we're dealing with.
We're talking tonight about the view from China as Chinese President Jiang Zemin has flown into the United States today, looking at the world according to Beijing. What do you think? Is a booming, looming China a threat or a partner in growth and global stability? And do you welcome or fear China as the next superpower? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the view from China as Chinese President Jiang Zemin flies into the United States today. We are looking at the world according to Beijing. What about you? Do you see China as a long-term ally? Do you think China sees the United States that way? Is there anything you're wearing that's not made in China tonight? Does that matter? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by David M. Lampton. He's professor of China Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and director of China programs at the Nixon Center, and by Thomas Christensen, professor of political science at MIT. You can join us as well. David's on the line. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you tonight?
Fine, thanks.
I guess I am afraid of a Chinese superpower, and I don't like a lot of things they do, especially in Tibet and with their minority groups.
Mm-hmm.
But it's no doubt that George Bush Sr. was right in pushing a constructive engagement policy with China. It's definitely been the right thing to do. It's worked with China. And I just wish his son would apply a similar policy, to other countries in the world, maybe countries we're not so scared of.
Such as?
Cuba, Iran. It's obvious even now that Korea is begging for a more engaged relationship with us.
It's an interesting perspective. Let's put it to our guest, David. Hang on. David Lampton, how about it? Can we see China, or the U.S. relationship with China, as a model for other potentially hostile or hostile nations the U.S. could engage with, as we have with China over the last 20 years, and maybe come out more fruitfully?
Well, I tend to agree with the caller, particularly in the case of Cuba. I mean, I think if you ask yourself the question, would Fidel Castro still be in power, leading the regime he has led since the 1950s, if the United States had had a full court press on engagement, scholarly exchange, trade? I think it's almost inconceivable that Castro would remain in power, or if he did, he'd be a very different Castro than the one we have confronted over the last several decades.
That may be the easiest case of those three.
Yeah.
Iran, Iraq?
Well, Iran, we're getting further afield from my expertise, but my sense is we may be losing an opportunity to, in effect, ally with the Iranian people and, in fact, progressive elements within the Iranian government itself. And I would like to see a little bit more aggressive engagement policy with them. On the other hand, you do have the mullahs, and they control, in the end, the political system. That's a tough nut to crack. But I'd be willing to be a little more bold in our engagement policy with Iran.
David, caller David, do you really see Iran and Iraq as equally susceptible, or Iraq in any case, to that approach?
No. Iraq is we've pushed that situation so far that it's almost impossible to turn around now. But no, I said Iran and Korea.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But Iran, yes. I mean, there's a powerful democratic desire there, and a desire for more openness. And we should be. Aligning ourselves more completely with those forces there.
It is a pretty astonishing example that we see in China. David, thanks for your call. Marcia's on the line. Hi, Marcia. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Good to have you.
Two things. I really think that, and tonight I'm quite pleased with the level of discussion and the complexity that this issue is being dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
Our relationship to China, we need to be clear that North Korea would not have nuclear capacity without the help of China. And we need to acknowledge that, and that is a complex relationship, and I think we need to manage this in a different way.
Marcia, are you suggesting a direct link between North Korea's now claimed nuclear weapons and Chinese sourcing somehow?
What I'm suggesting is that China knew North Korea was working on nuclear capacity. I don't believe that they could have funneled that information from Pakistan without China's knowledge. And I think, I think Americans are growing into a more complex understanding of the world. And what I like about tonight's discussion is, we're going to have to give up on the Taiwan issue to stay in communication with the Chinese, because in actuality, there's a couple of places in the world we're not going. There's two places we're not ever going again. That's Vietnam and Korea. Let's get real about that. And there's one place and we're not going is China. There's 1 billion people there. So we need to be able to be in communication with these people and work with them in a healthy way.
But Marcia, I want to go to your central point about North Korea. Let's say we accept your premise. I'm not sure that my guest tonight will, but if China is in some degree responsible for North Korea's going nuclear, how should the United States respond to that in its China relations?
But see, that's the problem with us as Americans. We don't understand that the world is much more complex. Mm. China can help to arm North Korea and still want to be about manufacturing, et cetera, and being in relationship to us. Mm-hmm. They're looking out for what's best for them, just like we're looking out for what's best for us. Because we look at everything from a Western standpoint, we're not looking from their standpoint that they need to be in relationship with the rest of the world. America is not the be-end-all.
Well, we've got that, and we are looking, or trying to look, at China's viewpoint tonight. Marcia, thanks for the point, and I want to dive into this, Tom Christensen, if we may. First of all, just to touch quickly again on China's potential responsibility, if there is some, in North Korea going nuclear. And secondly, maybe more fully, how do you see China playing a part in the resolution of this nuclear weapons crisis in North Korea?
Okay, I want to be really clear about this. I don't think that China is directly responsible for North Korea going nuclear. In fact, I think China has been a very constructive actor cooperating with the United States throughout the 1990s to try to prevent exactly that outcome. China doesn't have any interest in North Korea going nuclear. And China, there are various reasons, but one of the reasons is the one that David Lampton touched on before. There's a fear in China that if North Korea goes nuclear, that Japan might go nuclear. That fear may even be exaggerated in China, but there are reasons for exaggerated fears in China about Japanese military power.
Given the history there.
And they don't want to see a nuclearized Japan. And as one Chinese military officer said to me, even if Mexico had friendly relations with the United States wouldn't want a nuclear power in Mexico so close to home. So
you're not going to connect those dots too tightly, but talk to us about the resolution of this.
Okay.
What role will China play? How important will it be to the U.S., South Korea and Japan as people try and work this out with Pyongyang?
I think it's important first to restate the connections that I made before, which is it's Chinese proliferation policy in general that helps create a situation where such an outcome could occur. And where China
these materials get onto the world market.
And the technology and the know-how. Where China did cooperate in a way that is not pleasing to American security interests is by helping Pakistan develop nuclear weapons. And apparently, from the recent reports, Pakistan helped North Korea. Another place where China has proliferated in a way that was arguably damaging to stability was sending ballistic missile technology to Pakistan. Now, once you do that and you're trying to restrain an actor like North Korea, and I do believe China is trying to restrain North Korea, it's much more difficult to say, you shouldn't do what we did last year.
The cat's out of the box.
Cat's out of the bag. And I think that's the problem. Can China help us on North Korea? Yes, I think it's helped us in the past and it can help us in the future. Nobody has more connections with the North Korean regime than the Chinese regime, and they have a very rocky relationship. We could use their cooperation on that, and I think that that cooperation is likely to be forthcoming. We do have not everything is a zero-sum game, and we do have some common interests, as David has said.
If I might,
David Lampton,
add,
please.
The caller mentioned complexity, and I liked that. Mm-hmm. The Chinese, I think, the most important thing they can do, maybe at the moment, to stabilize the North Korean situation or contribute to that outcome is to contribute to the interest that I think the North Koreans are now showing in economic reform. And for a number of years, China's been encouraging North Korea to fundamentally change its society and its economic system. And indeed, about a year ago, the Chinese took Kim Jong-il, the leader of North Korea, to the General Motors plant in Shanghai.
I said, check this out. But we recently saw that China arrested the Chinese tycoon who was supposed to be instrumental in opening up a free trade zone in North Korea. It looked like a roadblock.
Well, I think that had more probably to do with elite politics, and there seems to be now retaliation among different leadership groups in China against various entrepreneurs that are allied with each group. I think that's more about Chinese politics than it is the idea that North Korea would open up. I think the Chinese were offended that the North Koreans didn't bother to tell them they were going to do that. But the whole thrust of Chinese policy for the last several years and I think continuing is that North Korea needs to build an entirely new economic system, at least learning what lessons are appropriate from China. And if the Chinese can help the North Koreans open up their economy and their society, I think we all ought to be very appreciative of that contribution.
That's huge. It's certainly an enormous model standing right there in the middle of Asia. David M. Lampton, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you.
David Lampton is professor of China Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and author of Same Bed, Different Dreams, Managing U.S.-China Relations, 1989-2000. And Tom Christensen, thanks so much for coming in. It's been great having you tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Christensen is professor of political science at MIT. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. When President Bush meets with Jiang Zemin this week, he is expected to press the Chinese leader on the case of longtime American resident and Chinese political dissident Yang Jianli. The 39-year-old resident of Brookline, Massachusetts, was arrested in China in April for allegedly trying to buy a plane ticket with false papers. For the past 6 months, his whereabouts have remained unknown even to his wife, Christina Fu, who has unsuccessfully sought clarification from the Chinese government about her husband's fate. In this radio diary, Christina Fu reflects on her hopes for this week's meeting between President Bush and Jiang Zemin.
The last time I heard him was April 27th, when he was in a hotel and he told me there were two police friends were with him and they were very nice, but I'm not sure how long I'm going to be here. Probably I will be transferred to another place very soon. And that's about 10 a.m. our time and 10 p.m. their time. So when I tried to call him at about 11 a.m., he was no longer there. And since then, I haven't heard from him. The first letter sent by the Congress was from Congressman Christopher Cox to President Bush on April 30th. Another letter sent by Representative Barney Frank, Tom Lantos, Frank Wolf, and Chris Smith. And their letter was received, and they did get a reply from the Chinese embassy, basically saying a man who claimed to be Yang Jianli has entered China illegally. The law enforcement facilities are doing an investigation on his real identity and his illegal activities in China. Now, because of we wanted to seek cooperation of China on anti-terrorism campaign, I was afraid some time ago that the human rights issue will be forgotten, will be overshadowed by other issues. But from my communication with the State Department and also Congress office, I was assured that human rights issue is important, is as important as anti-terrorism. There is a possibility that President Bush himself will personally encourage to have this case resolved. I was also told, if not, at least Secretary of State Colin Powell will also bring it up with at another meeting. So that's why I do have a hope my husband can come home shortly after the presidential summit. Through all this, I basically try to keep myself busy. Every day I have a to-do list with 20 things I wanted to do, and I couldn't do all of them. And also through all the supports from my church, my work, and through Congress office and their staff, I feel that with all the help, this will eventually be resolved, and my husband will come home.
Christina Fu is the wife of Yang Jianli, a Brookline, Massachusetts resident who has been detained in China for the past 6 months. Yang Jianli is president of the Foundation for China in the 21st Century. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.